This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents A Hidden Wholeness, The Journey Toward an Undivided Life, Welcoming the Soul and Weaving Community in a Wounded World, by Parker J. Palmer, read by Stefan Rudnicki. Prelude, The Blizzard of the World. The blizzard of the world has crossed the threshold, and it has overturned the order of the soul. Leonard Cohen. There was a time when farmers on the Great Plains, at the first sign of a blizzard, would run a rope from the back door out to the barn. They all knew stories of people who had wandered off and been frozen to death, having lost sight of home in a whiteout while still in their own backyards. Today, we live in a blizzard of another sort. It swirls around us as economic injustice, ecological ruin, physical and spiritual violence, and their inevitable outcome, war. It swirls within us as fear and frenzy, greed and deceit, and indifference to the suffering of others. We all know stories of people who have wandered off into this madness and been separated from their own souls, losing their moral bearings and even their mortal lives. They make headlines because they take so many innocents down with them. The lost ones come from every walk of life. Clergy and corporate executives, politicians and people on the street, celebrities and schoolchildren. Some of us fear that we, or those we love, will become lost in the storm. Some are lost at this moment and are trying to find the way home. Some are lost without knowing it. And some are using the blizzard as cover while cynically exploiting its chaos for private gain. So it is easy to believe the poet's claim that the blizzard of the world has overturned the order of the soul. Easy to believe that the soul, that life-giving core of the human self, with its hunger for truth and justice, love and forgiveness, has lost all power to guide our lives. But my own experience of the blizzard, which includes getting lost in it more often than I like to admit, tells me that it is not so. The soul's order can never be destroyed. It may be obscured by the whiteout. We may forget or deny that its guidance is close at hand. And yet we are still in the soul's backyard, with chance after chance to regain our bearings. This book is about tying a rope from the back door out to the barn so that we can find our way home again. When we catch sight of the soul, we can survive the blizzard without losing our hope or our way. When we catch sight of the soul, we can become healers in a wounded world, in the family, in the neighborhood, in the workplace, and in political life, as we are called back to our hidden wholeness amid the violence of the storm. Chapter 1. Images of Integrity. Living Divided No More. Jack pines are not lumber trees, and they won't win many beauty contests either. But to me, this valiant old tree, solitary on its own rocky point, is as beautiful as a living thing can be. In the calligraphy of its shape against the sky is written strength of character and perseverance, survival of wind, drought, cold, heat, disease. In its silence, it speaks of wholeness, an integrity that comes from being what you are. Douglas Wood. Into the Wilderness. Every summer, I go to the Boundary Waters, a million acres of pristine wilderness along the Minnesota-Ontario border. My first trip years ago was a vacation, pure and simple. But as I returned time and again to that elemental world of water, rock, woods, and sky, my vacation began to feel more like a pilgrimage to me, an annual trek to holy ground driven by spiritual need. Douglas Wood's meditation on the jack pine, a tree native to that part of the world, names what I go up north seeking, images of how life looks when it is lived with integrity. Thomas Merton claimed that, There is in all things a hidden wholeness. But back in the human world, where we are less self-revealing than Jack Pine's, Merton's words can at times sound like wishful thinking. Afraid that our inner light will be extinguished or our inner darkness exposed, we hide our true identities from each other. In the process, we become separated from our own souls. We end up living divided lives, so far removed from the truth we hold within, that we cannot know the integrity that comes from being what you are. My knowledge of the divided life comes first from personal experience. I yearn to be whole, but dividedness often seems the easier choice. A still, small voice speaks the truth about me, my work, or the world. I hear it, and yet act as if I did not. I withhold a personal gift that might serve a good end, or commit myself to a project that I do not really believe in. I keep silent on an issue I should address, or actively break faith with one of my own convictions. I deny my inner darkness, giving it more power over me, or I project it onto other people, creating enemies where none exist. I pay a steep price when I live a divided life, feeling fraudulent, anxious about being found out, and depressed by the fact that I am denying my own selfhood. The people around me pay a price as well, for now they walk on ground made unstable by my dividedness. How can I affirm another's identity when I deny my own? How can I trust another's integrity when I defy my own? A fault line runs down the middle of my life, and whenever it cracks open, divorcing my words and actions from the truth I hold within, things around me get shaky and start to fall apart. But up north, in the wilderness, I sense the wholeness hidden in all things. It is in the taste of wild berries, the scent of sun-baked pine, the sight of the northern lights, the sound of water lapping the shore, signs of a bedrock integrity that is eternal and beyond all doubt. And when I return to a human world that is transient and riddled with disbelief, I have new eyes for the wholeness hidden in me and my kind, and a new heart for loving even our imperfections. In fact, the wilderness constantly reminds me that wholeness is not about perfection. On July 4, 1999, a 20-minute maelstrom of hurricane-force winds took down 20 million trees across the boundary waters. A month later, when I made my annual pilgrimage up north, I was heartbroken by the ruin and wondered whether I wanted to return. And yet on each visit since, I have been astonished to see how nature uses devastation to stimulate new growth, slowly but persistently healing her own wounds. Wholeness does not mean perfection. It means embracing brokenness as an integral part of life. Knowing this gives me hope that human wholeness, mine, yours, ours, need not be a utopian dream if we can use devastation as a seedbed for new life. Beyond ethics. The divided life comes in many and varied forms. To cite just a few examples, it is the life we lead when we refuse to invest ourselves in our work, diminishing its quality and distancing ourselves from those it is meant to serve. We make our living at jobs that violate our basic values, even when survival does not absolutely demand it. We remain in settings or relationships that steadily kill off our spirits. We harbor secrets to achieve personal gain at the expense of other people. We hide our beliefs from those who disagree with us to avoid conflict, challenge, and change. We conceal our true identities for fear of being criticized, shunned, or attacked. Dividedness is a personal pathology, but it soon becomes a problem for other people. It is a problem for students whose teachers phone it in while taking cover behind their podiums and their power. It is a problem for patients whose doctors practice medical indifference, hiding behind a self-protective scientific facade. It is a problem for employees whose supervisors have personnel handbooks where their hearts should be. It is a problem for citizens whose political leaders speak with forked tongue. As I write, the media are filled with stories of people whose dividedness is now infamous. They worked at such places as Enron, Arthur Andersen, Merrill Lynch, WorldCom, and the Roman Catholic Church, to name a few. Surely these people heard an inner call to wholeness, but they became separated from their own souls, betraying the trust of citizens, stockholders, and the faithful, and making our democracy, our economy, and our religious institutions less trustworthy in the process. These particular stories will soon fade from the front page, but the story of the divided life will be in the news forever. Its drama is perennial, and its social costs are immense. The poet Rumi said it with ruthless candor 800 years ago, "If you are here unfaithfully with us, you're causing terrible damage." How shall we understand the pathology of the divided life? If we approach it as a problem to be solved by raising the ethical bar, exhorting each other to jump higher, and meeting out tougher penalties to those who fall short, we may feel more virtuous for a while, but we will not address the problem at its source. The divided life, at bottom, is not a failure of ethics. It is a failure of human wholeness. Doctors who are dismissive of patients, politicians who lie to the voters, executives who cheat retirees out of their savings, clerics who rob children of their well-being, these people, for the most part, do not lack ethical knowledge or convictions. They doubtless took courses on professional ethics and probably received top grades. They gave speeches and sermons on ethical issues and more than likely believed their own words. But they had a well-rehearsed habit of holding their own knowledge and beliefs at great remove from the living of their lives. That habit is vividly illustrated by a story in the news as I write. The former CEO of a biotechnology firm was convicted of insider trading and sentenced to 7 years in prison after putting his daughter and elderly father in legal jeopardy by having them cover for him. Asked what was on his mind as he committed his crimes, he said, "I could sit there, thinking I was the most honest CEO that ever lived, and at the same time glibly do something wrong and rationalize it." Those words were spoken by an expert at compartmentalizing, a much-prized capacity in many lines of work, but at bottom no more than a six-syllable name for the divided life. Few of us may share the speaker's fate, but many of us already share his expertise. We developed it at school, where ethics, like most subjects, tends to be taught in ways that leave our inner lives untouched. As teenagers and young adults, we learned that self-knowledge counts for little on the road to workplace success. What counts is the objective knowledge that empowers us to manipulate the world. Ethics, taught in this context, becomes one more arm's-length study of great thinkers and their thoughts, one more exercise in data collection that fails to inform our hearts. I value ethical standards, of course, but in a culture like ours, which devalues or dismisses the reality and power of the inner life, ethics too often becomes an external code of conduct, an objective set of rules we are told to follow, a moral exoskeleton we put on hoping to prop ourselves up. The problem with exoskeletons is simple. We can slip them off as easily as we can don them. I also value integrity, but that word means much more than adherence to a moral code. It means the state or quality of being entire, complete, and unbroken, as in integer or integral. Deeper still, integrity refers to something, such as a Jack Pine or the human self, in its unimpaired, unadulterated, or genuine state, corresponding to its original condition. When we understand integrity for what it is, we stop obsessing over codes of conduct and embark on the more demanding journey toward being whole. Then we learn the truth of John Middleton Murray's remark, "For the good person to realize that it is better to be whole than to be good is to enter on a straight and narrow path, compared to which his or her previous rectitude was flowery license." Living divided no more. A jackpine, solitary on its rocky point, is one of the loveliest sights I know. But lovelier still is the sight of a man or woman standing with integrity intact. Speak the names of Rosa Parks or Nelson Mandela, or other names known nowhere but within your own grateful heart, and you catch a glimpse of the beauty that arises when people refuse to live divided lives. Of course, wholeness comes more easily to jackpines than to human beings. Pinus banksia is unable to think itself into trouble. We are cursed with the blessing of consciousness and choice, a two-edged sword that both divides us and can help us become whole. But choosing wholeness, which sounds like a good thing, turns out to be risky business, making us vulnerable in ways we would prefer to avoid. As I was working on this book, Time magazine published its 2002 year-end issue, naming Cynthia Cooper, Colleen Rowley, and Sharon Watkins its Persons of the Year. They were honored for confronting corruption at WorldCom, the FBI, and Enron, respectively, honored for turning their consciousness toward living divided no more. They took their inner truth into the outer world, reclaiming their personal wholeness and helping our society reclaim some of its own. Sadly, such courage is not universally admired. Sharon Watkins has been reviled by some of her ex-colleagues at Enron, who believed that if she had kept her mouth shut, they could have saved the company and their jobs. Since much of the evidence suggests that Enron had become a massive shell game, their criticism tells us less about a good business plan than about how unpopular integrity can be. "There is a price to be paid," said Cynthia Cooper of WorldCom. "There have been times that I could not stop crying." In the wash of information that surrounds us, the stories of Cooper, Rowley, and Watkins will soon be swept away. And yet I have to wonder, is information overload our problem? Or did we want to forget how these three witnessed to the real-world possibility of an undivided life? That three ordinary people refused to live a lie means the rest of us could do it too, if we were willing to embrace the challenge of becoming whole. But we cannot embrace that challenge all alone, at least not for long. We need trustworthy relationships, tenacious communities of support if we are to sustain the journey toward an undivided life. That journey has solitary passages, to be sure, and yet it is simply too arduous to take without the assistance of others. And because we have such a vast capacity for self-delusion, we will inevitably get lost en route without correctives from outside of ourselves. Over the years, my own need for community has led me to collaborate with others in creating settings where there is mutual encouragement for rejoining soul and role. One result has been a national retreat program for public school educators who face daily threats to their personal and professional integrity, threats that, if they go unmet, will imperil our children's well-being. As word of that program spread, people in other arenas, parents and politicians, clergy and physicians, community organizers and corporate executives, youth workers and attorneys, began to ask where they could get similar help. In response, the program was expanded to help people from many walks of life bring their integrity more fully into the world. So this book is not a theory in search of applications. The principles and practices explored here have been proven on the ground. Now they seek even wider use wherever people want to live undivided lives that are joined to the needs of the world. The first half of the book explores the sources of our dividedness and of the call to live divided no more. The second half offers guidance for creating settings where people can support each other on the journey toward an undivided life. Chapter 2, Diagnoses the Divided Life, examines its personal and social consequences, and tells stories of what integrity looks like from infancy into adulthood. Chapter 3 lays out evidence for the claim that we arrive in this world with a soul or true self, and looks at what happens when we ignore, defy, or embrace our own truth. Chapter 4 explores a paradox. Our solitary journey toward rejoining soul and role requires relationships, a rare but real form of community that I call a circle of trust. Chapter 5 names the preparations required if that inner journey in community is to take us somewhere worth going. Chapters 6, 7, 8, and 9 describe in detail the practices necessary to create spaces between us where the soul feels safe enough to show up and make its claim on our lives. Chapter 10 makes the case that the principles and practices explored in this book can help us walk the path of nonviolence in our everyday lives. Can we learn to respond to the mounting violence of our time with soul-honoring and life-giving ways of being in the world? Much depends on the answer. Chapter 2. Across the Great Divide, Rejoining Soul and Role. As once the winged energy of delight carried you over childhood's dark abysses, now beyond your own life build the great arch of unimagined bridges. Rainer Maria Rilke. A Child's Secret Life. The instinct to protect ourselves by living divided lives emerges when we are young, as we start to see the gaps between life's bright promise and its shadowy realities. But as children, we are able to deal with those dark abysses by sailing across them on the winged energy of delight that is every child's birthright gift. This energy comes from the soul, the core of pure being that children are so intimate with, that is, as the poet Rumi says, here for its own joy. The remarkable resilience youngsters often reveal, even in the face of great hardship, comes from this place called the soul. And the soul animates the secret lives that many of us led as children in an effort to shield our vulnerable selfhood from the threats of the world. My own secret life started in the 5th or 6th grade. At school, where I wanted to fit in, people saw me as outgoing and self-assured. I made friends easily, knew how to get a laugh, often had my hand up in class, and was elected president of one thing and another more often than FDR. Though I could not dribble a basketball down court without tripping over myself, my clumsiness served me well, making me less threatening to other boys and evoking the maternal instinct in girls. But no one knew how anxious my public role made me. After school, I did not hang out with friends. I hid out in my bedroom. With the door shut tight against the world, I read stories, built model airplanes, or immersed myself in the fantasy realm of radio serial adventures. My room was a monastic cell where I could be the self with whom I felt most at home, the introspective and imaginative self, so unlike the extrovert I played with such anxiety at school. The details of this story are mine alone. But at bottom, it is the story of most people I know. As we cross the rising terrain between infancy and adolescence, still close enough to our origins to be in touch with inner truth, but aware of the mounting pressure to play someone else out there, the true self starts to feel threatened. We deal with the threat by developing a child's version of the divided life, commuting daily between the public world of role and the hidden world of soul. The secret lives of children have inspired some splendid literature, of course. In C.S. Lewis's classic Chronicles of Narnia, we read about a magic wardrobe through which young Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy pass from their humdrum existence in the English countryside into a parallel universe of light and shadow, of mystery and moral demand, confronting the daunting and bracing challenges of the inner journey. I have never doubted the truth of the Narnia tales. That magic wardrobe was in my bedroom, too. But when we turn from literature to life, This charming feature of childhood soon disappears, to be replaced by an adult pathology. As the outer world becomes more demanding, and today it presses in on children at an obscenely early age, we stop going to our rooms, shutting the door, walking into the wardrobe, and entering the world of the soul. And the closer we get to adulthood, the more we stifle the imagination that journey requires. Why? Because imagining other possibilities for our lives would remind us of the painful gap between who we most truly are and the role we play in the so-called real world. As we become more obsessed with succeeding, or at least surviving in that world, we lose touch with our souls and disappear into our roles. The child with a harmless after-school secret becomes the masked and armored adult, at considerable cost to self, to others, and to the world at large. It is a cost that can be itemized in ways well known to many of us. We sense that something is missing in our lives and search the world for it, not understanding that what is missing is us. We feel fraudulent, even invisible, because we are not in the world as who we really are. The light that is within us cannot illuminate the world's darkness. The darkness that is within us cannot be illuminated by the world's light. We project our inner darkness on others, making enemies of them and making the world a more dangerous place. Our inauthenticity and projections make real relationships impossible, leading to loneliness. Our contributions to the world, especially through the work we do, are tainted by duplicity and deprived of the life-giving energies of true self. Those are not exactly the marks of a life well lived, but they are not uncommon among us, in part because the dividedness that creates them comes highly recommended by popular culture. Don't wear your heart on your sleeve and hold your cards close to your vest are just two examples of how we are told from an early age that masked and armored is the safe and sane way to live. But our culture has it backward. The truth is that the more dividedness we perceive in each other, the less safe and sane we feel. Every day, as we interact with family, friends, acquaintances, and strangers, we ask ourselves if what we see is what we get, and all those other people are asking the same about us. Being cautious about the degree of congruence between outer appearance and inner reality is one of our species' most ancient ways of seeking safety in a perilous world. Is this person the same on the inside as he or she seems to be on the outside? Children ask this about their parents, students about their teachers, employees about their supervisors, patients about their physicians, and citizens about their political leaders. When the answer is yes, we relax, believing that we are in the presence of integrity and feeling secure enough to invest ourselves in the relationship and all that surrounds it. But when the answer is no, we go on high alert. Not knowing who or what we are dealing with and feeling unsafe, we hunker down in a psychological foxhole and withhold the investment of our energy, commitment, and gifts. Students refuse to take the risks involved in learning. Employees do not put their hearts into their work. Patients cannot partner with physicians in their own healing. And citizens disengage from the political process. The perceived incongruity of inner and outer, the inauthenticity that we sense in others or they in us, constantly undermines our morale, our relationships, and our capacity for good work. So, masked and armored, it turns out, is not the safe and sane way to live. If our roles were more deeply informed by the truth that is in our souls, the general level of sanity and safety would rise dramatically. A teacher who shares his or her identity with students is more effective than one who lobs factoids at them from behind a wall. A supervisor who leads from personal authenticity gets better work out of people than one who leads from a script. A doctor who invests selfhood in his or her practice is a better healer than one who treats patients at arm's length. A politician who brings personal integrity into leadership, helps us reclaim the popular trust that distinguishes true democracy from its cheap imitations. Becoming whole adults. The divided life may be endemic, but wholeness is always a choice. Once I have seen my dividedness, do I continue to live a contradiction, or do I try to bring my inner and outer worlds back into harmony? Being whole is a self-evident good, so the answer would seem to be clear. And yet, as we all know, it is not. Time after time, we choose against wholeness by slipping into a familiar pattern of evasion. First comes denial. Surely what I have seen about myself cannot be true. Next comes equivocation. The inner voice speaks softly, and truth is a subtle, slippery thing. So how can I be sure of what my soul is saying? Next comes fear. If I let that inner voice dictate the shape of my life, what price might I have to pay in a world that sometimes punishes authenticity? Next comes cowardice. The divided life may be destructive, but at least I know the territory, while what lies beyond it is terra incognita. Then comes avarice. In some situations, I am rewarded for being willing to stifle my soul. This pattern of self-evasion is powerful and persistent. But here is a real-world story about someone who found the courage to break out of it and embrace his own truth. It happened at a retreat I facilitated for some 20 elected and appointed officials from Washington, D.C. All of them had gone into government animated by an ethic of public service. All were experiencing painful conflicts between their values and power politics, and all sought support for the journey toward living divided no more. One participant had worked for a decade in the U.S. Department of Agriculture, after farming for 25 years in northeastern Iowa. On his desk at that moment was a proposal related to the preservation of Midwestern topsoil, which is being depleted at a rapid rate by agribusiness practices that value short-term profits over the well-being of the earth. His farmer's heart, he kept saying, knew how the proposal should be handled. But his political instincts warned him that following his heart would result in serious trouble, not least with his immediate superior. On the last morning of our gathering, the man from agriculture, looking bleary-eyed, told us that it had become clear to him during a sleepless night that he needed to return to his office and follow his farmer's heart. After a thoughtful silence, someone asked him, "How will you deal with your boss, given his opposition to what you intend to do?" "It won't be easy," replied this farmer-turned-bureaucrat. "But during this retreat, I've remembered something important. I don't report to my boss. I report to the land." Because this story is true, I cannot give it a fairy tale ending. I do not know if this man returned to work and did exactly what he said he would do. His resolve may well have weakened by the time he got back home. And even if he held firm, the topsoil of Midwestern farmlands has yet to be saved. The policy process is too complex to be redirected by one person's moment of truth. The man from agriculture went on a pilgrimage into the wilderness of the human heart, and I cannot claim that his pilgrimage solved his or the topsoil's problems any more than my pilgrimage to the boundary waters solves my problems or the world's. But this I can claim. Every time we get in touch with the truth source we carry within, there is net moral gain for all concerned. Even if we fail to follow its guidance fully, we are nudged a bit further in that direction. And the next time we are conflicted between inner truth and outer reality, it becomes harder to forget or deny that we have an inner teacher who wants to lay a claim on our lives. As that awareness grows within us, we join in the potential for personal and social change that, in the words of Václav Havel, architect of the Velvet Revolution, former president of Czechoslovakia, and seeker of political integrity, is hidden throughout the whole of society. This potential, Havel writes, is found in everyone who is living within the lie and who may be struck at any moment by the force of truth. The divided life is a wounded life, and the soul keeps calling us to heal the wound. Ignore that call, and we find ourselves trying to numb our pain with an anesthetic of choice, be it substance abuse, overwork, consumerism, or mindless media noise. Such anesthetics are easy to come by in a society that wants to keep us divided and unaware of our pain. For the divided life that is pathological for individuals can serve social systems well, especially when it comes to those functions that are morally dubious. When the man from agriculture distances himself from his soul, it is easier for his department to report to the agribusiness lobby instead of the land. But when he or any of us rejoins soul and role, the institutions in which we work find it just a little bit harder to ransack another ecosystem to satisfy corporate greed or to lay off another 10,000 working poor to maximize the profits of the rich or to pass another welfare reform that leaves single mothers and their children worse off than they were. Of course, if the man from agriculture began reporting to the land, he may well have become a less desirable employee in his superior's eyes. He may have been told to get back in line or else lose his power or even his job. Institutions have been known to punish people for living integral lives. No one wants to suffer the penalties that come from living divided no more. But there can be no greater suffering than living a lifelong lie. As we move closer to the truth that lives within us, aware that in the end what will matter most is knowing that we stayed true to ourselves, institutions start losing their sway over our lives. This does not mean we must abandon institutions. In fact, when we live by the soul's imperatives, we gain the courage to serve institutions more faithfully, to help them resist their tendency to default on their own missions. If the man from agriculture acted on his farmer's heart, he did not renege on his institutional obligations, but embraced them more fully, helping to call his department back to its higher purpose. It is not easy work rejoining soul and role. The poet Rilke, who wrote about childhood's winged energy of delight in the stanza at the start of this chapter, writes about the demands of adulthood in the final stanza of the same poem. Take your practiced powers and stretch them out until they span the chasm between two contradictions. For the God wants to know himself in you. Living integral lives as adults is far more daunting than recovering our childhood capacity to commute between two worlds. As adults, we must achieve a complex integration that spans the contradictions between inner and outer reality, that supports both personal integrity and the common good. No, it is not easy work. But as Rilke suggests, by doing it, we offer what is sacred within us to the life of the world. False community. How does the divided self become whole? How to do it questions are commonplace in our pragmatic culture, and so are the mechanistic answers they often evoke. Here is a 10-step program you can pursue in the privacy of your own home, or on the flight between JFK and LAX, to achieve an undivided life. Do these exercises and your life will be transformed. Solutions of that sort are snake oil, of course. The quick-fix mentality that dominates our impatient world serves only to distract us from the lifelong journey toward wholeness. And the self-help methods so popular in our time, the best of which offer us support for that journey, sometimes reinforce the great American illusion that we can forever go it alone. Of course, solitude is essential to personal integration. There are places in the landscapes of our lives where no one can accompany us. But because we are communal creatures who need each other's support, and because left to our own devices, we have an endless capacity for self-absorption and self-deception, community is equally essential to rejoining soul and role. The story of the man from agriculture illustrates the point. Clearly, his journey had a solitary side. For weeks he had been chewing on his problem privately, and his breakthrough came in the depths of a sleepless night, one of the most solitary times we know. But without the kind of community that surrounded him on that retreat, he might not have had his breakthrough. To avoid an endless interior recycling of his dilemma, he needed other people in whose presence he could speak his soul. That kind of community, one that knows how to welcome the soul and help us hear its voice, I call a circle of trust. Gathering in circles is an ancient practice being revived in our time. We have dialogue circles to improve communication, conflict resolution circles to negotiate crises, therapeutic circles to explore our emotions, problem-solving circles to puzzle out hard questions, team-building circles to cheerlead for a common cause, and collaborative learning circles to deepen our education. All of them have worthy purposes, but none of them has the singular intent of a circle of trust, to make it safe for the soul to show up and offer us its guidance. Indeed, some circles are simply unsafe for the soul, a fact I learned the hard way as a graduate student at Berkeley in the 1960s. Like many young Americans of that era, I was learning about the inner life and hoping to bring its powers to bear on a variety of social ills. In the process, I sometimes found myself sitting in circles with people who were exploring ideas, plotting revolution, doing amateur group therapy, or brewing a mad mix of all three. At first, these gatherings fascinated me. As one who grew up in the Stoic 1950s, when we always sat in straight rows, I found Berkeley's circles exotic, energizing, and exhilarating. But my fascination soon faded. Some of those circles went round and round, taking us nowhere useful in the world. Some were thinly disguised exercises in narcissism and self-congratulatory piousity. And some were simply unsafe for human habitation. People in them were manipulated and sometimes violated by the group. Not all circles honor the soul. Some insult and invade it. I think, for example, of the so-called tea groups or encounter groups that sprang up in the 1960s. The basic ground rule for such circles is that each participant be willing to disclose feelings that she or he may have in the moment about others in the group and to solicit feedback from the others about herself or himself. Practicing that rule may evoke emotional candor, but that candor is often the kind that people come to regret as they find out how transient and untrustworthy feelings in the moment can be. There may be situations in which evoking instant emotion is helpful, but tea groups, even at their best, do not welcome the soul, which distrusts confrontation because its dynamics run so much deeper than momentary feelings. Circles that scare the soul away can still be found today, not merely in the remnants of the counterculture, but at the heart of our dominant institutions. I once spoke with an executive of a Fortune 500 company that was trying to change the corporate culture. His company, he said, had been flattening the organization in hopes of doing its work better. The hierarchical power charts had been taken down from the office walls. Now, instead of a pyramid, there were circles in which people from the front office joined with people from the factory floor to share information, identify problems, and make decisions. But this executive and some of his colleagues had started to understand that many people participated in those egalitarian circles while harboring a hierarchy within. Here is how he described the situation. On one side of the circle sits a manager saying silently, "Okay, I'll play this game for a while, but when push comes to shove, I'm the one who has the know-how and gets paid to make this decision right. When I get back to my office, I'll find some way around whatever this group comes up with. I'll play the circle game, but I won't invest myself in it." Meanwhile, across the circle sits a person from the shop floor saying silently, "Okay, I'll play this game for a while, but I don't get paid enough to worry about stuff like this. I just want to do my job and get back home where I have a life without having to take my work with me. Besides, the managers are going to figure out how to get their way with all this. I'll play the circle game, but I won't invest myself in it." My conversation partner continued, "If we can't address these inner issues, we need to put those pyramid charts back up because they represent what is happening in this company more honestly than our little circles game. As long as we pretend to be something that we are not, Our work won't get better, and it may get worse. Even if you were not around to do Berkeley in the 60s, and tea groups are not your style, you may have been an unwilling participant in the kind of charade I just described. It has become the standard in too many workplaces. We can put the chairs in a circle, but as long as they are occupied by people who have an inner hierarchy, the circle itself will have a divided life, one more form of living within the lie, a false community. True community. 5 years after leaving Berkeley, I found myself sitting in circles again. This time it was at Pendle Hill, a Quaker living learning community near Philadelphia, where I spent 11 years starting in the mid-1970s. But these circles, I soon discovered, were of a different sort. They were not heady, aggressive, self-congratulatory, or manipulative. They were gentle, respectful, and reverent in the way they honored self and world, and slowly they changed my life. In these quiet Quaker circles, people were doing neither the amateur psychotherapy nor the faux politics that I had experienced in Berkeley. Instead, they were doing therapy and politics rightly understood, reaching in toward their own wholeness, reaching out toward the world's needs, and trying to live their lives at the intersection of the two. In these quiet Quaker circles, I saw people challenged, but I never saw anyone harmed. I witnessed more personal transformations than I had seen before, and I watched more people embrace their social responsibilities as well. That was when I started to understand why Quakers, who have always been few in number, have often been overrepresented in the great social issues of their time. The circles of trust I experienced at Pendle Hill are a rare form of community, one that supports rather than supplants the individual quest for integrity that is rooted in two basic beliefs. First, we all have an inner teacher whose guidance is more reliable than anything we can get from a doctrine, ideology, collective belief system, institution, or leader. Second, we all need other people to invite, amplify, and help us discern the inner teacher's voice for at least three reasons. The journey toward inner truth is too taxing to be made solo. Lacking support, the solitary traveler soon becomes weary or fearful and is likely to quit the road. The path is too deeply hidden to be traveled without company. Finding our way involves clues that are subtle and sometimes misleading, requiring the kind of discernment that can happen only in dialogue. The destination is too daunting to be achieved alone. We need community to find the courage to venture into the alien lands to which the inner teacher may call us. I want to dwell for a moment on that little word, discern, which means distinguish between things. I think again of C.S. Lewis's Tales of Narnia, that land of inwardness the children enter through the back of the magical wardrobe. There is much in Narnia that is good and beautiful, especially the voice of truth, the voice of Aslan, the great lion, that is sometimes heard in the land. But there are other voices in Narnia as well, voices of temptation, deception, darkness, and evil. It takes four children, a variety of guides, and seven volumes of pitfalls and perils to sift through this mix of messages and travel toward the truth. Occasionally I hear people say, "The world is such a confusing place that I can find clarity only by going within." Well, I, for one, find it at least as confusing in here as it is out there, usually more so. And I think most people do. If we get lost in New York City, we can buy a map, ask a local, or find a cabbie who knows the way. The only guidance we can get on the inner journey comes through relationships in which others help us discern our leadings. But the kind of community I learned about at Pendle Hill does not presume to do that discernment for us, as communities sometimes do. You tell us your version of truth, and we will tell you whether you are right or wrong. Instead, a circle of trust holds us in a space where we can make our own discernments, in our own way and time, in the encouraging and challenging presence of other people. The man from agriculture went on retreat with peers who doubtless could have offered him seasoned counsel about his dilemma. But at this moment on his journey, a moment when it was critical that he take his own soul seriously, he needed people who were willing to abstain from giving advice. He needed people who knew how to invite his soul to speak and allow him to listen. Blessedly, the people he sat with, guided by the principles and practices that shape a circle of trust, never tried to set him straight. Instead, they created a communal space around him where he could distinguish the inner voice of truth from the inner voice of fear. And as he spoke the truth he heard from within, these people bore witness to his self-discovery, sharpening his sense of self and strengthening his resolve to follow the inner teacher. Here's another story about what can happen when a community welcomes the soul. In a circle I hosted, there was a good man who had been wounded by racism. In the course of our 3-day retreat, he spoke only once or twice. Most of the time he sat in silence. His face, it seemed to me, a mask of sorrow. Because he was an African American in a predominantly white group, I feared not only that he was in pain, but that we were in some way causing it. For 3 days, I worried that this man felt like an outsider even here, in a circle that was supposed to be safe. But following the ground rules of this form of community, neither I nor anyone else tried to fix him. Instead, we held him and his soul in a quiet and respectful way, though it took a mighty act of will to keep from offering him consolation. On the last morning of our retreat, I got up early. Sitting in the common room with a cup of coffee, I picked up the journal that the retreat center's staff had left there for guests to comment on their experience. On the last page I found these words, written in a bold scrawl, signed by the man about whom I was so worried. "Thank you for helping to deal with some of my anger. Life is too short to walk a path filled with spurs. I am not completely healed, but the process has begun. I want to give back the love and caring that was given to me. This retreat made me deal with my ghost. Georgia, Nam, Texas were all my pits. Now that the healing has started, I feel strong and for the first time capable of feeling some sense of peace." Reading those words, I realized that for the past 3 days this man had been talking with his inner teacher, going much deeper in that dialogue than he could have by talking with us. Once again, I felt profoundly grateful for the circles I first experienced at Pendle Hill, grateful for what they taught me about the reality and power of the soul, about a way of being together that allows the soul to make a claim on our lives, and about the miracles that can happen when we do. If we want to renew ourselves and our world, we need more and more circles of this sort, where people who work in a large corporation can acknowledge the secret hidden in plain sight, where a conflicted farmer turned bureaucrat can remember that he reports to the land, where a person wounded by racism can take a step toward healing. We need more and more circles from which we can return to the world less divided and more connected to our own souls. The circles described in this chapter ranged from 10 to 30 people. But a circle of trust is not defined by numbers. It is defined by the nature of the space it creates between us. Diana Chapman Walsh, president of Wellesley College, a leader whose integrity I deeply admire, has written about the small-scale circles she convenes to maintain her sense of wholeness in a complex and stressful job. "I come together with people who bring out my better self, friends with whom I can be authentic. I make it a point to connect whenever possible with people with whom I have a history of shared joy and shared pain, who call forth in me this feeling of safety." A circle of trust can form wherever two or three are gathered, as long as those two or three know how to create and protect a space for the soul. What exactly happens in a circle of trust that supports an inner journey by making the soul feel safe? The second half of this book answers that question in considerable detail. But the practices that create a circle of trust will make little sense until we understand the two key principles behind them, that the soul or true self is real and powerful, and that the soul can feel safe only in relationships that possess certain qualities. These principles are the subjects of the next two chapters. Chapter 3. Explorations in True Self. Intimations of the Soul. You formed my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I am fearfully and wonderfully made. My soul knows that very well. Psalm 139, verses 13 to 14. Spiritual DNA. When true self is the topic, children are the best source because they live so close to their birthright gifts. So I begin this chapter with another reflection on childhood. But instead of revisiting my own youth, as I did in Chapter 2, I want to look at someone else's early years from the vantage point of my mid-60s. When my first grandchild was born, I saw something in her that I had missed in my own children some 25 years earlier, when I was too young and self-absorbed to see anyone, including myself, very well. What I saw was clear and simple. My granddaughter arrived on Earth as this kind of person, rather than that, or that, or that. As an infant, for example, she was almost always calm and focused, quietly absorbing whatever was happening around her. She looked as if she got everything, enduring life's tragedies, enjoying its comedies, and patiently awaiting the day when she could comment on all of it. Today, with her verbal skills well honed, this description still fits the teenager who is one of my best friends and seems like an old soul. In my granddaughter, I actually observed something I could once take only on faith. We are born with a seed of selfhood that contains the spiritual DNA of our uniqueness, an encoded birthright knowledge of who we are, why we are here, and how we are related to others. We may abandon that knowledge as the years go by, but it never abandons us. I find it fascinating that the very old, who often forget a great deal, may recover vivid memories of childhood, of that time in their lives when they were most like themselves. They are brought back to their birthright nature by the abiding core of selfhood they carry within, a core made more visible, perhaps, by the way aging can strip away whatever is not truly us. Philosophers haggle about what to call this core of our humanity, but I am no stickler for precision. Thomas Merton called it true self. Buddhists call it original nature or big self. Quakers call it the inner teacher or the inner light. Hasidic Jews call it a spark of the divine. Humanists call it identity and integrity. In popular parlance, people often call it soul. And thus far in this book, I have called it by most of these names. What we name it matters little to me, since the origins, nature, and destiny of call it what you will are forever hidden from us, and no one can credibly claim to know its true name. But that we name it matters a great deal. For it is the objective, ontological reality of selfhood that keeps us from reducing ourselves or each other to biological mechanisms, psychological projections, sociological constructs, or raw material to be manufactured into whatever society needs, diminishments of our humanity that constantly threaten the quality of our lives. "Nobody knows what the soul is," says the poet Mary Oliver. "It comes and goes like the wind over the water." But just as we can name the functions of the wind, so we can name some of the functions of the soul without presuming to penetrate its mystery. The soul wants to keep us rooted in the ground of our own being, resisting the tendency of other faculties like the intellect and ego to uproot us from who we are. The soul wants to keep us connected to the community in which we find life, for it understands that relationships are necessary if we are to thrive. The soul wants to tell us the truth about ourselves, our world, and the relation between the two, whether that truth is easy or hard to hear. The soul wants to give us life and wants us to pass that gift along, to become life givers in a world that deals